Victory or death!
Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death!
I think you do make a very good point that what COVID-19 exposed, which I was shocked by, I knew that there were a lot of drones. I knew that there were a lot of weak people in America. I knew that we were not the same generation that won World War II, let alone founded the United States. I knew all that. What I did not think, though, was that 90%+, 95%, 98% of the population was willing to just hand over virtually all their freedoms, destroy their own businesses, bankrupt themselves, lock themselves in their own home, shut their own churches down. I mean, literally just give up all their freedom without even the boot of government being on their throat. This was not accomplished at gunpoint. They just did it because they were told to. I didn't think of that level of, drone compliance existed in American society. So I think you make a very good point there. And so I would argue, I know for sure today, America, I would argue, is not fit for self-government. It's just not. We are not the moral and religious people that John Adams said is required for a constitution. We're not the educated people that Jefferson said was necessary. And we're not the people of masculinity and courage and virtue that Washington said are essential to being a republic. We're just not. But what I am also hopeful of, and I say even maybe confident in, is that the trends of history, that there are a lot of people that will not repent. They will not change until every other option has been exhausted and they have absolutely no choice. And even the American founders, we build up to be this, mythical generation of heroes, which in many cases they were. We forget that they endured 20+ years of increasing ratcheting down of tyranny from Great Britain before they finally mobilized and acted. So I do think that there is still a chance out there, and you're seeing rumblings of this in the American populace, that if they keep ratcheting it down, we're actually forced to our knees as a people, that there's a chance we won't just kneel to the tyrant. When we're forced on our knees, we'll repent, come back to God, and then have the strength to be men again and throw off the chains of tyranny.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon, the voice of freedom, behind enemy lines here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, equipping you, the patriots, with the information you need in the fight to preserve your liberty. This is episode 21-22, the 22nd episode of 2021. And if you want to learn more about the show, you can find out more at radiofreevirginia.com. You'll find show notes and other needed information there. Also, check out the new merch store where I've started to create some things like mugs and mouse pads and t-shirts and other cool things. And my goal is to actually create a new design every week and get it up there to tell you about it. This week's design, there's already one up there already, but there's a new one. And this week's design is a picture of a Black Hawk helicopter, and it says helicopters plus communists equal freedom. And there's a little picture of some guys falling out. And if you get the white one, it's all black lettering and graphics. But if you get the OD green, it's red, white, and blue guys falling out of the helicopter. So if you'd like to support the show and sport some fun, pithy merch from the show, you can do that by going to radiofreevirginia.com. Before I forget, today's show is brought to you by Acticare of the Blue Ridge, actikare.com/blue-ridge, ActiCare is in-home senior care for your loved one when you can't be there. So if you're looking for somebody that can take care of somebody that you love and will do a good job, then get in touch with ActiCare. Whether you're in Smith Mountain Lake, Bedford, Roanoke, Campbell, Lynchburg, out in the country, get in touch with them, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. And John and his team will take good care of you. Well, today's episode, I'm going to talk about a couple different things. I'm going to share with you the first part. I shared with you the second part of the interview with John Galt. And in today's episode, we're going to be talking about military purges, the Rainbow Jihad, tuition mercenaries versus patriots in the military, and a few other things. I think you'll really enjoy that. It is the Killdozer anniversary, so I'll be sharing some information about that. And it is also the anniversary of Normandy. That was actually June 6th. So we'll start first with the Killdozer anniversary. The anniversary of the Killdozer event in Granby, Colorado was on June 4th. This year is the 14th anniversary of Killdozer's rampage through Granby, Colorado. Sit down, kids, and let me tell you a tale about a reasonable man driven to do unreasonable things. Marvin Heemeyer was a man who owned a muffler shop in Granby, Colorado. The city council ordained to approve the construction of a concrete factory in the lot across from Marvin's shop. In the process, this blocked the only access road to the muffler shop. Marvin petitioned to stop the construction to no avail, petitioned to construct a new access road, and even bought the heavy machinery to do so himself. Denied. The concrete factory went up and disregarded the ramifications on Marvin's business. To add insult to injury, the factory construction disconnected the muffler shop from the city sewage lines. An indifferent city government then chose to fine Marvin for this. His business and livelihood were in ruin. Rather than lie down and die, Marvin chose to fight back. Over the course of a year and a half, Marvin secretly outfitted the bulldozer he bought to save his business with 3-foot-thick steel and concrete armor, camera systems guarded with bulletproof glass. And on June 4th, 2004, Marvin Heemeyer lowered his armored shell over the top of himself, entombing himself inside the Killdozer to make his last stand. He burst forth from the walls of his muffler shop and straight into the concrete factory that ruined his business. Over the course of the next several hours, Marvin drove his Killdozer through 13 buildings owned by those officials that had wronged him, including the city council building itself. SWAT teams swarmed the dozer, but it proved immune to small arms fire and even explosives. Another piece of heavy machinery was even brought out to fight the Killdozer, but it too fell to the dozer's righteous fury. In the end, Marvin's Killdozer became trapped in one of the buildings it was built to destroy. Marvin chose to take his life, the only life he took that day. Today we celebrate Killdozer Day, and Marvin Heemeyer, the last great American folk hero, a man driven to the brink, who chose to fight back against an indifferent system. From a note he left behind after his passing, "I was always willing to be reasonable, until I had to be unreasonable. Sometimes reasonable men must do unreasonable things. When injustice becomes the law, resistance becomes duty." Right or wrong? Well, you tell me. I mean, you got to ask yourself, what would you do? What would you do if the local government not only was deaf to your pleas, but was complicit in the destruction of your livelihood? There's a lot of Marvin Heemeyers out there right now with all this COVID nonsense and everything else. And I wouldn't be surprised if something like this happens again. I do know that I can't fault him for what he did. And there is some amazing video of this event. Just type up Killdozer, type up Marvin Heemeyer, H-E-E-M-E-Y-E-R. There are a lot of reasonable people out there, and they're right on the edge of unreasonable things. So, Sir Marvin Heemeyer, I salute you. Well done. Next on my list of topics is Normandy, June 6th. Let's listen to what the Supreme Allied Commander said prior to the invasion.
"Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the Great Crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Normandy is an amazing thing, an amazing feat of courage and strength and fortitude that pretty much is the epitome of our United States military. Amazing. Just incredible. You've seen lots of movies made about it. 50 miles of beach. And because of that invasion and the success there, United States and other countries were able to defeat the scourge that was Nazi Germany. We should have finished off the Russians while we were at it. That's what Patton wanted to do, but we didn't. I wanted to share with you one man's Medal of Honor story. This is First Lieutenant Jimmy Monteith Jr., 16th Infantry, 1st Infantry Division. Citation: for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty on June 6, 1944. Near Colleville-sur-Mer, France, 1st Lieutenant Monteith landed with the initial assault waves on the coast of France under heavy enemy fire. Without regard to his own personal safety, he continually moved up and down the beach, reorganizing men for further assault. He then led the assault over a narrow protective ledge and across the flat, exposed terrain to the comparative safety of a cliff. Retracing his steps across the field to the beach, he moved over to where two tanks were buttoned up and blind under violent enemy artillery and machine gun fire. Completely exposed to the intense fire, First Lieutenant Monteith led the tanks on foot through a minefield and into firing positions. Under his direction, several enemy positions were destroyed. He then rejoined his company, and under his leadership, his men captured an advantageous position on a hill, supervising the defense of his newly won position. Against repeated, vicious counterattacks, he continued to ignore his own personal safety, repeatedly crossing the 200 or 300 yards of open terrain under heavy fire to strengthen the links in his defensive chain. When the enemy succeeded in completely surrounding First Lieutenant Monteith and his unit, and while leading the fight out of the situation, First Lieutenant Monteith was killed by enemy fire. The courage, gallantry, and intrepid leadership displayed by First Lieutenant Monteith is worthy of emulation. The men that landed on D-Day were amazing. I mean, you've seen the videos, and some of these are real, and you've seen recreations of this, but it's incredible. They essentially knew with pretty good certainty they weren't going to make it. You just had, they threw bodies at the problem. Now we would drop smart bombs and do different things before, but it's an incredible thing. And guys like this did incredible things on that day. And that's what Memorial Day, which we just celebrated, was all about, is the men who died. We honor them and we thank them. First Lieutenant Monteith, I salute you. Well done, sir. And thank you for contributing to the destruction of Nazi Germany. Something I also wanted to share with you was a clip by Tucker Carlson And he's talking about these Fauci emails. You may have heard of these. And what was interesting, and the reason I want to share this with you, is if you're a listener to this podcast for any length of time, you will recognize some of the things that Tucker is saying and that Fauci was saying, and they're the things I said. So let's have a listen.
Tucker Carlson tonight. The utter fraudulence of Tony Fauci is obvious now, and it's widely acknowledged, but it was not always obvious. In March of last year, we interviewed Fauci on this show. We treated him with respect. We took his answers seriously. We're Americans, so we assumed the man in charge of protecting the U.S. from COVID must be rational and impressive. We also assumed he must be honest, but we were wrong. It soon became clear that Tony Fauci was just another sleazy federal bureaucrat, deeply political and often dishonest. More shocking than that, we then learned that Fauci himself was implicated in the very pandemic he'd been charged with fighting. Fauci supported the grotesque and dangerous experiments that appeared to have made COVID possible. We came to these conclusions incrementally, spurred by evidence that accumulated over the course of a year. Tonight, we have the mother lode. Thanks to a Freedom of Information request from BuzzFeed, we have thousands of emails to and from Anthony Fauci. They go back to the early winter of 2020. Collectively, they show that from the beginning, Tony Fauci was worried that the public might conclude COVID had originated at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Now, why would Tony Fauci be concerned that Americans would conclude that? Possibly because Tony Fauci knew perfectly well that he had funded gain-of-function experiments at that very same laboratory. The emails prove that Fauci lied about this under oath. Consider this exchange, which began the evening of January 31st, 2020. It was a Friday just before midnight. The first email came from an immunologist called Christian Anderson, who works at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California. Anderson warned Fauci that COVID appeared to have been possibly manipulated in a laboratory. Quote, "The unusual features of the virus make up a really small part of the genome, less than 0.1%. So one has to look really closely at all the sequences to see that some of the features potentially look engineered." The next day, on February 1st, Tony Fauci wrote back, "Thanks, Christian. Talk soon on the call." Fauci then sent an urgent email to his deputy, a man called Hugh Auchincloss. The subject of that email, in all caps, was important. Quote, "Hugh, it is essential that we speak this AM. Keep your cell phone on. Read this paper as well as the email that I will forward. You will have tasks today that must be done." Attached to that email was a document. It was entitled, quote, "Barrick, Shi et al., Nature Medicine, SARS Gain of Function, .pdf. Now, the Barrick in the attachment referred to Ralph Barrick, a virologist based in the U.S. who collaborated with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Barrick worked with a woman called Dr. Shi Shengli, known as the Bat Lady because she manipulates coronaviruses that infect bats. She was the Shi in the attachment. Now, keep in mind that during the questioning from Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky fairly recently, Tony Fauci denied that this same Ralph Barrick had conducted gain-of-function research. Again, this is the Ralph Barrick in Fauci's attachment, which was entitled Barrick, Shi et al., SARS Gain of Function, .pdf. And yet, under oath before the United States Congress, Fauci denied this.
Dr. Barrett does not doing gain of function research, and if it is, it's according to the guidelines, and it is being conducted in North Carolina. And if you look at the grant and you look at the progress reports, it is not gain of function, despite the fact that people tweet that.
Oh, it wasn't just on Twitter. It was in Fauci's own emails. In retrospect, that looks a lot like perjury. We do know that starting early last year, a lot of people at NIH were worried that COVID had not occurred naturally. They were concerned it had been instead manipulated in a lab in China. And yet they seemed determined to hide those facts from the public. Again, why? On the afternoon of February 1st last year, Fauci held a conference call with several top virologists. Most of the details of that call were made hidden from public view. They've been redacted. We know the call was related to a document entitled Coronavirus Sequence Comparison. Jeremy Farrar, a British physician who runs a major research nonprofit, reminded everyone on the call that what they said was top secret. Quote, "Information and discussion is shared in total confidence and not to be shared until agreement on next steps," end quote. In other emails, Jeremy Farrar passed along an article from the website Zero Hedge. That piece suggested the coronavirus might have been created as a bioweapon. We now know that is a more plausible explanation explanation than the one we believed at first and were told by the media, which is that Corona came from a pangolin. And yet for the crime of saying that out loud, a more plausible explanation, Zero Hedge was banned from social media platforms. Until recently, you were not allowed to suggest that COVID might be man-made. Why couldn't you suggest that? The fact checkers wouldn't allow it. Why wouldn't they? Because Tony Fauci assured the tech monopolies that the coronavirus could not have been man-made. And so the tech monopolies shut down the topic. Watch Fauci lie.
A group of highly qualified evolutionary virologists looked at the sequences there and the sequences in bats as they evolve. And the mutations that it took to get to the point where it is now is totally consistent with a jump of a species from an animal to a human.
That was April 17th, 2020, very shortly into the course of this pandemic. At that point, what Tony Fauci just asserted as known could not conclusively have been known. That was a lie. Tony Fauci suggested that he knew because top researchers had decided conclusively that this must have jumped naturally from an animal to a human being. But again, at that point, he could not have known that. That was dishonest. 2 days after he said that, one of the virologists that Tony Fauci had funded to conduct dangerous coronavirus experiments in Wuhan wrote to thank him for the help. That man, a man called Peter Daszak, complained to Fauci that the American tax dollars he'd taken for these experiments were being, quote, publicly targeted by Fox News reporters. Yet Daszak remained grateful for Tony Fauci's support. Quote, I just wanted to say a personal thank you on behalf of our staff and collaborators, end quote. Now, strangely, most of this specific email from Daszak to Fauci has been redacted, and it was redacted under FOIA Section B7A. That specific exemption to the FOIA law applies to, quote, records or information compiled for law enforcement purposes, but only to the extent that production of those documents could reasonably be expected to interfere with enforcement proceedings. Are Peter Daszak and Tony Fauci under criminal investigation? We can only hope they are. They certainly deserve it. At this point, we can't say for sure. We do know that Fauci hasn't simply lied about the origins of COVID, pretending to know things he could not know. He has also lied about vaccines in key ways. In March of last year, former Obama official Zeke Emanuel wrote to Fauci to ask a very simple question, one that we've asked countless times. Are people who have recovered from COVID generally immune from getting infected with COVID once again? That applies to about 100 million Americans, so it's not a small question. Fauci's response, quote, no evidence in this regard, but you would assume that there would be substantial immunity post-infection. Well, yes, you would assume that. We always have. And in fact, studies now show it is true. People who have had COVID and recovered almost never get sick again from COVID, so they don't need to be vaccinated. Yet to this day, Tony Fauci has never admitted that in public. In his email to Zeke Emanuel, he admitted something else that's also now obvious. Surgical masks, the paper kind all of us wear, don't really work. They offer very little protection from COVID. In fact, at least one study shows they may accelerate transmission of viruses. They are, in short, a form of make-believe. Yet once again, while under oath in public, Tony Fauci claimed precisely the opposite.
You're telling everybody to wear a mask, whether they've had an infection or a vaccine. What I'm saying is they have immunity, and everybody agrees they have immunity. What studies do you have that people that have had the vaccine or have had the infection are spreading the infection? If we're not spreading the infection, isn't it just theater?
No, it's
not.
You had
the vaccine and you're wearing two masks. Isn't that theater?
No, that's not. Here we go again with the theater. Let me just state for the record that masks are not theater. Masks are protective, and we
have immunity there, theater. If you already have immunity, you're wearing a mask to give comfort to others. You're not wearing a mask because of any science.
I totally disagree with you.
Rand Paul is a physician. He's smart. What he just said was true, and the science shows that it's true. There's not much debate about it, actually, among honest people. But Tony Fauci claimed it wasn't true. He lied. Why would he do that? Well, here's one reason. The emails show that Tony Fauci speaks regularly to Bill Gates. That's odd. Bill Gates is not a doctor. Bill Gates is not a scientist. Bill Gates is a very rich man who made billions making mediocre software for office computers. So why would Tony Fauci be in such regular contact with Bill Gates? The term Bill Gates comes up more than 24 times when you search the Fauci emails. Has Bill Gates profited in any way from Tony Fauci's COVID guidance? That would definitely be worth knowing. And yet we don't know. Our media don't seem interested in finding out. In fact, here's how CNN covered the emails today. Quote, thousands of emails from and to Dr. Fauci revealed the weight that came with his role as a rare source of frank honesty within the Trump administration's COVID-19 task force. Can you imagine a more dishonest characterization of anything than that? By the way, it wasn't just CNN. No reporters asked about these emails at today's White House press briefing. Not one question. But you shouldn't be surprised. Of course they didn't ask. Tony Fauci is too big to question at this point. Quote, oh my God, one Biden voter wrote to Tony Fauci back in March. Is there anything I can do for you besides being grateful? Wash my feet with your tears, Fauci may have responded. We can't say that he did respond that way for certain. We don't have his reply. We do know that in affluent neighborhoods throughout Northwest Washington, D.C., you can still see signs that say, thank you, Dr. Fauci. What does that tell you? It tells you that Tony Fauci is no longer a scientist, assuming he ever was one. Tony Fauci is a figure of religious veneration. He is Jesus for people who don't believe in God.
And I'd like to thank the Armchair Survivalist for that clip, which I snipped off of his show. Are you surprised? Are you surprised about any of this? I've been saying, and many of us have been saying, that this is a scam, that this is nonsense. And yet here we are. So we'll see if anything comes of this. I would bet not. I would bet not. And the reason is Democrats never face charges for their crimes, ever. When was the last time? When was the last time a Democrat faced charges for the evil deeds that they were doing? The communists, when do they ever get their comeuppance? I can't remember the last time. If you can, send me a message at producer@radiofreevirginia.com and let me know, because I'd like to know. I'd like to have an example of a Democrat who was punished. I mean, shoot, Charlie Rangel cheated on his taxes for 17 straight years. You know what happened to him? Nothing. He wrote the dumb tax law. Can't say he didn't know. All right, next I want to share, before I get to the interviews, I want to share with you an email I received. I will keep the person's name out. I wanted to respond on the show, though, because I thought this was interesting. And I thought it was cool because the guy lives in New York and he's listening to Radio Free Virginia. So thank you, sir, for listening. And he says, please advise, I'm a lifelong resident of upstate New York, 15 minutes north of West Point in the Hudson River Valley, the foothills of the Catskill Mountains, and surrounded by apple orchards and vineyards in a now diminishing R+1 county. If I'm reading that right, that's Republican plus one. So, strong Republican county. Strong-ish Republican county. 80 miles south of us is a growing cancer, New York City. My wife, family, friends, and I have been fighting this cancer since 2007, but we are slowly seeing our way of life slipping away, and I believe the end is near. My wife and I retired, so we are now looking to relocate, possibly to Virginia. What say you on the conditions in your state? If I'm forced to balkanize, I need to know I'm making the right move, as I may not get a second chance. I need to live in a place where I can carry a gun, sail a boat, operate an amateur radio, fish hunt in peace. What say you? Well, sir, I say Virginia would be happy to have more patriots, for sure. So it's a tough question to answer. Virginia is my home, and I will fight for it. I think there is very few places you can go to avoid the coming fight. In fact, I would say there's nowhere you can go to avoid the coming fight. The question is, what will you do and who will you surround yourself with when it is time to fight? Which I think we're past there, but that's a separate, separate argument. Virginia is a great place. There's a lot of great patriots here, especially in the rural areas. I would avoid anything in Northern Virginia. You mentioned sailing, which I think is an amazingly fun thing to do. I got the chance to do that when I was in South Carolina and just loved it. So, to answer your question, how are things in Virginia? Let me maybe answer it in a little bit different way. There are a couple places I might consider going myself, if I was going to go somewhere else, if this wasn't my home and I didn't think it was worth fighting for. Tennessee is at the top of my list. Solidly Republican supermajority the way California has a Democrat supermajority. I don't think they're probably doing enough with it, but that's a separate problem. It's a beautiful place, just like Virginia. It's got a lot of the same terrain, a lot of the same mountain styles, a lot of the same climate. Tennessee is a beautiful place. Great tax structure. Now, there isn't sailing. Probably good amateur radio, which I'm a ham. Probably good hunting and fishing. I personally don't hunt. I fish a little. Not very good at it. And, of course, very gun-friendly. As at the moment, Virginia is, because the politicians have learned that we will kill them if they pass any laws restricting our Second Amendment rights. They seem to have figured that out in this last legislative session. They didn't touch any of it. So, would I move to Virginia from New York? In comparison, apples to apples, as a state, Virginia is much more conservative, much more Republican, much more free than New York. Just hands down, much more free. And you're going to be able to move here and set up shop and probably sell your place, buy something here for cash, be able to afford to have a boat in a slip somewhere. There's a lot of great places in Virginia Beach and in the coastal areas that are very conservative. Now, they're much more densely populated than I care for. I wouldn't want to live there, but I don't know what your area is like as far as dense population or how much you're used to that or if that's even a factor. But those areas that are very conservative, that are near the coast, would offer you a lot of the hunting and fishing and radio and freedom that you would enjoy and like to have. Now, as a state, we've got a lot of problems with trying to take back our political stuff. And if you've listened to the show, you know what we're dealing with. But I think Virginia is absolutely a great place, absolutely worth fighting for. And we would be happy to have a patriot like you. I will be sending you an email letting you know I've responded and also, you know, if, be willing to talk to you and help point you in the right direction for, you know, where you might want to move that would fit the needs that you have. Virginia Beach from Central Virginia, where I live, is about 3.5 hours away. So a little bit of a drive, but there are plenty of conservative areas along that route that you could move to and be free. So I hope that answers your question, and I hope that helps anyone else that might be out of the state thinking of moving here. Great place. Birthplace of America, a lot of history, a lot of neat things. And now we go to the interview with John Galt.
You know, I know you've got some interesting insights, but one of the questions I wanted to ask is, you see this a lot in the news about, you know, the military and they just, you know, fired this guy over at the Air Force and there's all this, you know, critical race.
Well, I think it was Space Force, right?
Space Force, sorry. You know, yeah. You're right, Space Force. And they're, but there's all this, you know, critical race theory and they're purging conservatives. And, you know, is this really happening? Or is this just like, oh, they're cherry picking media stories?
So I think it is happening. And there is a purge is probably too strong of a word because it's not quite that systematic yet. I think what people have to understand about the military is that as an institution, it's very large. So people are usually familiar with the idea that the military is divided up into its respective branches. So we have Space Force, which is new, and the Marines, the Navy, Army, Air Force, and so on. And those services each have a very different culture and kind of a unique way of dealing with different problems. And beyond that, you have the active duty force, and then you have the reserves components of those various services. And then you have the National Guard. And these, although they're all part of the military, they all behave very differently. So what I'll say is that, yes, is there a new shift within the military to basically deter people from actively being conservative, having conservative views? Is there even some purging going on in some of the services or in some sub-organizations? I think that's definitely happening. And, you know, people I know in the military have indicated that They've seen it. That even every once in a while you see something leak of someone doing a presentation on something like extremism, for example. So the military advertisers doing this stand down for extremism, trying to teach soldiers not to be part of extremist organizations. And but I can tell you that's varied widely. So you have some stuff that's been leaked and you see a PowerPoint presentation and basically they have identified extremist organizations as only being right wing. You've seen other presentations that kind of pop up where it's right and left wing organizations that identify as extremist. Some of the training that I've seen in the military and other people have shared with me is that they basically took that DOD directive and watered it down and made it so that it was fairly innocuous, you know, basically telling you not to be a communist or a Nazi. And other than that, didn't really push any political agenda. So I think that people have to understand that the military is not a monolithic institution in the sense that you can, even in the military, with military order and discipline, you can't issue a directive and it gets executed the same way. It's just way too big for that. And it varies at the National Guard level from state to state. Some states are more aggressive in being anti-conservative and pushing critical race theory and this type of stuff in the briefings and how they behave. And then you have other states like in the West and in the South that don't do it at all. So I think that people have to understand that the military is just not one big giant entity that is monolithic. And when people are making decisions about joining the military, my advice would be look at what service you're going to join. And if you're looking at joining something like the National Guard, look at this state and even the unit that's local to you. Because I think the military, there's still a lot of good to be done there. And one thing we can't do as conservatives is say, we're going to let the left own the military. It's why we lost education. It's why we lost the universities. It's why, quite frankly, we even lost a lot of the Christian church, is because conservatives, instead of fighting for an institution, decided to abandon them. Now, does that mean you got to go in with both eyes open and understand that you might have a ceiling to your career, or you might have to actually actively fight against some of these trends inside the institution? Absolutely. But I think it's dangerous on our side to just say, oh, the military looks like they're going a little woke, so we're just going to abandon that institution as well. I don't think that's a winning strategy in the long run.
Well, I noticed that we're really good at checking out, you know, conservatives. We just, oh, peace out, bye. And we just leave. and that's, I think, a large part of why we're where we are. You know, so you make a good point. A couple questions I would have to follow up with. What happens when they do start going to the purge in the, I guess readiness would be the word, or ability to actually fight an enemy? So let's start with that one. I mean, what happens? They go and they start doing this really, you know, on a legitimate scale and, you know, and just removing guys. What does that do to our military? Because every military guy I've met has been pretty conservative. I know you've probably, I know for a fact that, you know, from conversations we've had, you've come across some communists, and, you know, made sure to identify them and not use them for, things that are important. You know, the same could be true with, you know, of them identifying, you know, us. But we are people that think like us are, I think, more prevalent than the opposition, right?
So I think that we have to, we've talked about this before. If you look at the general makeup of the armed forces, I would say, generally speaking, the officer corps tends to lean more left than the enlisted ranks. You are much more likely to find somebody who's an officer who is either left-leaning, an outright leftist, or is kind of that squishy establishment Republican type of mentality. That is much more common in the officer corps than the enlisted ranks. The enlisted ranks tend to be much more conservative. And then it varies how close you are to the front. We've talked about this as well. The political attitudes you'll see in support units versus combat units are very different. And the closer you get to the front line, the more red, you know, quote unquote, the formation gets. So in terms of combat readiness, I think we have to understand, and that's the same with the officer corps too, by the way. Infantry officers, for example, tend to be much more conservative. Same thing with, you know, armor, artillery officers, guys who are at what we call the pointy end of the business, tend to be more conservative than people who are in logistics and other support functions. So if you're going to tell these people, you are not welcome in the armed forces. We don't like people who, you know, as Obama said, cling to their guns and their religion. Then I think we're going to see, and we're already seeing to some extent, depending on what branch and, you know, what component you're talking about, you're going to see a drain of military talent from the armed forces and an inability to replace it. Because let's just be honest here. If you saw the most recent Army recruiting commercial, the one that's kind of made the rounds, where it's, you know, this cartoon anime looking style and the whole thing is about celebrating gay rights and somehow the fact that this girl was a LGBTQ XYZ activist makes her, is going to make her a better soldier. That recruitment commercial, when contrasted with Russian recruiting propaganda, for example, you can see putting those two commercials side by side that those types of ad campaigns are going to attract very different people and they're going to turn off very different people. And the people who you need to fight and kill the enemies of the United States are not going to be attracted to that type of recruiting campaign if they're being told that if you're a Christian or a conservative, you're not welcome in the armed forces, or your views are going to be, you know, if they're not denigrated, at least viewed as suspicion, then the pool of people that comprise the armed forces, the fighting sections of the armed forces, are going to be very difficult to replace. And I think over a, even just a period of a few years, you're going to see overall military readiness significantly drop. And I would argue that to a certain extent, we've already seen it. You know, if you have a military that is more focused, or even if it has a sub-focus, racial equity and the critical race theory agenda and this type of stuff, that means that you're no longer focused on your primary task of winning the nation's wars, which the military hasn't been very good at anyway for the past 20 years. I mean, we just spent 20 years in Afghanistan and achieved nothing. So I'd argue our military is already in a degraded state of readiness, and this will only make it worse.
So you mentioned the video, and I thought it was funny immediately when I saw it. I haven't actually hunted down the other one because I know I've seen so many things of the propaganda sort that you're talking about that I'm like, I know what that's about. But I did watch the Russian one and it made me want to join the Russian military. I mean, I'm 47 and I was like, I want to do that. That looks cool. I mean, that was a good propaganda piece. And, you know, I mean, the guy wakes up and they all sit up at the same time and they all turn at the same time. I'm like, that's pretty good right there. And, you know, I think we've seen an immediate shift to, you know, people in the world over respect strength. And, you know, sometimes they respect it in the form of a tyrant and sometimes they, you know, just respect honest, you know, freedom loving strength. But what we've seen is Putin's done a really good job of establishing Russia as, you know, hey, we're here and we're legit. And immediately the whole world is looking to Russia and seeing all this propaganda they're putting out and they're doing these flyovers and these big military parades and they're doing all this stuff. And I'm like, well, that's an interesting shift because now everything is focused on, hey, look how awesome they are. And then we're putting out, I just joined the military and I'm a child of lesbians or whatever.
Yeah, and I think the contrast between those two, you know, if we were doing a TV interview, I'd put the two directly side by side and we'd watch them. But I think at an even deeper level than just, you know, one looks like a Cartoon Network recruiting commercial type of thing, you know, obviously the LGBTQ rainbow jihad agenda woven into it. And then the Russian one looks like a stern traditional military recruiting commercial. So that's the superficial level. You see the contrast there. I think there's something also deeper that shows, and I don't think Russia, this is necessarily true about Russia. Russia has its own deep problems, but shows a different value set that's being portrayed. So what is the American propaganda there? It's saying, look, we are here. The purpose of the military is to be inclusive. And we're showcasing, you know, this lesbian couple who raised this girl. And we're taking all of the values of Western civilization, the Kelvin, the Judeo-Christian tradition, and we are either rejecting them, turning them on their head. The commercial features a, you know, homosexual wedding and all this type of stuff. and we're saying this is who the army is, this is what America is. And then you compare that to the Russian commercial, and it starts out with some very traditionalist themes. So he doesn't just wake up in the barracks and he goes to some stern military training, but when it shows his transformation from the civilian to the soldier in the Russian commercial, he starts out, you know, holding his girlfriend, spending time with this girl that he obviously has some sort of emotional attachment to, either a girlfriend or fiance or wife or something like that. And it's a traditional call to the male ethos as the protector of those he loves and the protector of his nation. The Russian commercial is drawing on themes and ideas that have motivated men to go to war since the beginning of time, since the beginning of human history, that this is why men go and fight, to protect that which they love, their country, their honor, their wives, their children. And then what is the American commercial? It's come join the army because it is somehow part of your self-gratification, your, what I don't want you to call it, basically satisfying your selfish desires, or it's all about you. It's all about your calling. It's all about your life experience. It's about who you are instead of what you are willing to do to protect something higher and greater. So I think that just comparing those two pieces, you see that there's something deeper going on, where the cultural rot in America now is even showing up in our military mentality. And that commercial is just the stench of a deeper cultural rot that is not just going to degrade military readiness, but it's kind of the stench of a dying civilization that's no longer fit to defend itself.
Well, so what I thought about when you were talking about that was the selfishness side of things, was the guys and gals that, you know, can't meet the PT standards, that are just there for their college education. They're just like counting the clock, looking at their watch going, all right, when am I done with this thing? That's what I thought about. And those are the guys and gals, the 80-20, those are the 80% of the, you know, the 20% of the people that are 80% of your problem in the military. And that's not what we want, right? I mean, am I wrong there?
No, I mean, I think we've thrown out this term before, you know, the tuition mercenary. And that is an inherent problem with the way we've tried to do recruiting, I would argue, for the past, you know, probably 10, 20 years, even longer. And that is that if you don't have people who are joining primarily motivated by national service, and this is not that we shouldn't give military benefits. Those are great things to kind of buttress somebody's patriotism. You know, it's kind of like there's only three motives for human beings, right? So it's fear, love, and interest. And any guy who's married understands, it's like there's some things I do for my wife because I love her. There's some things I do because I'm afraid, like I don't want to deal with the backlash of not doing it. And there's other things that I do because it's very much in my interest to do this. Human beings need multiple types of incentives to do good things. So I'm not saying military incentives are inherently bad. But if somebody's primary motivation for being in the military is self-centered, either it's some form of self-actualization or some personal benefit, monetary or otherwise, and that's what makes them want to be a soldier, that is a weak motivation that often fails to get soldiers to do what's really necessary on the battlefield. The deeper motivations, or as some authors have called it, you know, the old gods that have motivated man throughout all time, that commitment to honor, to the nation, to your religion, to your family, those things that exist outside yourself that motivate you to do incredible things. That is what has made soldiers charge hills and charge into battles as far as we can tell for all of human history. Those are the great motivations. And if you say we're not going to use that, we're going to use self-actualization and money, you're just never going to produce the fighting force that's going to be capable of the feats of America's past.
Let's change the topic a little bit here. Let's talk about, there's talk now as we're approaching inflation, we're not approaching inflation, there's all this craziness, but I look at it and I think to myself, well, If I was just printing money and I had to control the money, I would devalue the money that by printing it, and that's kind of what we're doing. Where do you see? You know, I know it's hard to predict because, I mean, look, I thought we were going to fall apart back in 08 and here we are. But what do you see monetarily going on in the United States? And, you know, at what point are Americans going to look at that and go, hold on a second? And I'm curious if they'll ever say that, because quite many of them are getting a check.
So I actually think, strangely enough, this topic is linked to the previous topic. So when you have a fiat currency like we have, and you're the world's global reserve currency, you're kind of in this unique position where you can defy the laws of economics for an extended period of time. And I think there's a reason why, if you are, you know, from the Austrian school, or you're a libertarian or a fiscal conservative, you know, guys like you and I who've been on the right end of economics for a long time, have been perpetually surprised at the resiliency of the American regime, despite what seems like an endless series of fiscal blunders, ever larger bailouts, ever larger infrastructure projects, ever greater waste, ever greater dependency, and somehow the United States just keeps limping along, right? And how many times, like you said, we thought that this is going to be the last straw, this is going to be the thing that breaks the camel's back, and this is going to be the big crash. I think that this is actually linked to the previous topic, because what sustains a fiat currency, what sustains our position as the global reserve currency to a certain extent even, is that America exists as a military superpower, an economic superpower, and there's really no alternative or credible rival to the United States. That's been the case for a long time. And so when people look at the dollar and they go, okay, well, if I dump the dollar, what would I go to? Who else looks like they're the leader on the world stage? Who else looks like they have the economic or industrial capacity to compete with America? And for a lot of time, there wasn't anybody who was a competitor. But I think now you're looking at the rise of China, and you look at even some of the moves that Russia's making. And I'll just take one example from China for, you know, as a great example of this, not just military might that's growing in China, but also economic might. So right now, China has 1,000 shipyards. We have 10. China has one shipyard that can produce as much tonnage in a year as the entire shipyard industrial base of the United States. That's real economic power. That's not stuff on a spreadsheet. That's not stocks. That's not paper. That's real economic power. China has the largest shipping fleet in the world. They're building, I can't remember how many coal factories a month, but you look at China's raw industrial base and capacity, and it is rapidly expanding, and they're actually in the position that we were in during World War II, where if China ever had to go to war with anybody, they had this massive industrial base that could turn to military production. So say, how long is this going to last? Where's the currency going to go? I think that we're going to see hyperinflation, if not this year, and before the end of the Biden administration, definitely, even for a first term, assuming he lives through a first term. But within this new term we have, whether it's going to be Kamala or Biden, I think we'll see it. And the reason why is because, unlike Obama or Bush or anybody else who spent like crazy, the United States not only has increased spending, but we are losing the credibility of being a true superpower. And all that sustains a fiat currency is literally the faith of other countries, that this country, whoever it is, has the power to back up their economic moves. And I think that we're losing that credibility. And then the only thing I'll throw in on top of that is, the laws of economics can be defied, but they cannot truly be broken. At some point, what goes up must come down. It's just like the laws of physics here. You cannot sustain poor fiscal decisions indefinitely. So I kind of view the collapse of the American economy, the big collapse, sort of like the second coming of Christ. No man knoweth the hour, but you know it's going to happen at some point. So you should be prepared for it.
Final thoughts here. We were having an interesting conversation of how America almost needs, like, we almost need some dictator to break things enough for us to fix things. I mean, I don't like the idea, and, you know, bad things always happen with that kind of stuff, but it you know, I don't know that how do we fix it if we're not willing to break it? I mean, you know, I don't know. What you had some funny comments on that from a historical aspect of Rome and Caesar and some different things.
Yeah, so this is happening on some places on the right for actually openly talking about this. Yeah, there's a, you know, great website out there called The American Mind, and there's a podcast as well that goes along with the website, and that comes out of the Claremont Institute. And they're probably the, I guess, say the biggest, you know, think tank on the right that kind of explores these subtopics. And that's the question of Caesarism. You know, the ancients would tell you, you know, whether it's Aristotle or Cicero, you know, you go back and you read, you know, the Greeks and the Romans, they kind of argue that there's a cycle of regimes, and that if you have a successful democracy or republic, some sort of free government, free regime, that eventually they decay to a point where they are unfit for self-government. And the next transition is either to a total tyranny, you know, just, you know, a despotic king or a dictator. Or if you avoid that, the better scenario is you end up with a benevolent Caesar, you know, someone who exercises a form of absolute power, or maybe some modified or lessened absolute power, but nonetheless wields the power of a dictator justly, you know, and for righteous purposes. And I don't think that Caesarism is one of these things that we should advocate for in the United States, because there's a lot of people who would view themselves as being a righteous Caesar, but they have no such noble motivations. You know, it's just a way to cloak a power grab in virtue, and that can come from the right or the left. So I don't think it's something that we should openly advocate, but I think as conservatives, you know, especially as Christians, it'd be wise, you know, as the scriptures say, wise as serpent, innocent as doves, you know. Is it possible that we reach a point in American civilization where we are just so depraved, we are so corrupt, we have so dumbed down our own population, both with propaganda and just lack of education, that we are no longer a moral and religious people, or no longer a people who are fit for self-government? I think that is possible. And some people even argue that it's already occurred. And the best case scenario might be that we get a Caesar who restores some semblance of the old constitutional order, who will break the system, who will use semi-despotic powers to crush the radical left and restore some semblance of order to the United States. We see examples from the Old Testament, you know, this as well, you know, some Israelite kings, I think Josiah is the one I'm remembering, if I remember correctly, who restored Israel to a period of righteousness for a time by using the power of the state to tear down the altars of Baal and, you know, imposed the old Mosaic law and got rid of idolatry and witchcraft and, you know, kind of took the worst elements of Israelite society and just crushed it. So I think that is a real possibility. And as conservatives, as Christians, we have to recognize that there are some points in human history where that's the best you can get. And is that optimal? No. Even if we had the best Caesar possible, would it still be a day of mourning for those who remember the glorious days of the American founding when we were both free and faithful enough to the true God that we could live as a free people in a republic? Yes, it would still be a sad day, but it also might be the best scenario given the circumstances we're in or maybe in the future.
Well, I don't see any I mean, you look at the mask stuff and everything. I just think we're too stupid to fix things. You know, everyone's just bowing down and licking the boot of their servant government. And, it's, you know, I just don't see anyone, you know, pushing back. I think that, you know, when they talk about, you know, oh, they're coming after the guns, and I just look at them and go, well, I hope they do, and I hope they just go hog wild. Because the only thing patriots understand is when the boot is on their neck and they're like, wait a minute, I don't like this. So, you know, yeah, come get some. Let me
respond to that real quick, just to, I guess, kind of close up my thoughts, unless you have any other questions. But I think you do make a very good point that what COVID-19 exposed, which I was shocked by, I knew that there were a lot of drones. I knew that there were a lot of weak people in America. I knew that we were not the same generation that won World War II, let alone founded the United States. I knew all that. What I did not think, though, was that 90%+, 95%, 98% of the population was willing to just hand over virtually all their freedoms, destroy their own businesses, bankrupt themselves, lock themselves in their own home, shut their own churches down. I mean, literally just give up all their freedom. Without even the boot of government being on their throat. This was not accomplished at gunpoint. They just did it because they were told to. I didn't think of that level of, you know, drone compliance existed in American society. So I think you make a very good point there. And so I would argue, I know for sure today America, I would argue, is not fit for self-government. It's just not. We are not the moral and religious people that John Adams said is required for a constitution. We're not the educated people that Jefferson said was necessary. And we're not the people of masculinity and courage and virtue that Washington said are essential to being a republic. We're just not. But what I am also hopeful of, and I say even maybe confident in, is that the trends of history, that there are a lot of people that will not repent, they will not change until every other option has been exhausted and they have absolutely no choice. And even the American founders, we build up to be this, you know, mythical generation of heroes, which in many cases they were, we forget that they endured 20+ years of increasing ratcheting down of tyranny from Great Britain before they finally mobilized and acted. So I do think that there is still a chance out there, and you're seeing rumblings of this in the American populace, that if they keep ratcheting it down, we're actually forced to our knees as a people, that there's a chance we won't just kneel to the tyrant. We're forced on our knees, we'll repent, come back to God, and then have the strength to be men again and throw off the chains of tyranny.
Yeah. Well, John Galt, thank you for being on the show and answering the questions, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
All right. Thank you.
Well, that'll conclude this episode. I'd like to thank you for listening and remind you, you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.